Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. The nonpartisan Wisconsin Policy Forum came out with a report this week that showed the number of deer hunting licenses sold in the state dropped by roughly 50,000 over the last 20 years. As the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel puts it, that's like if everyone in the city of La Crosse stayed out of the woods. In this hour, Keith Warnke with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources talks about why there aren't as many hunters taking part in the tradition.
Generally, it's a demographic question because we have a population the population of hunters is strongly shaped by the baby boomer generation. So as baby boomers get older and age out of hunting participation, the number of hunters then is going to go down a little bit.
And, you know, there was a report that came out, and it said that the number of license sales had dropped around 6% from 1999 to 2017.
That's probably pretty much correct, yeah. I mean, we commissioned a demographic report from the Applied Population Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison to project numbers out to 2030, and the projections are amazingly accurate to what we're actually seeing in number of licenses sold. So this is a demographic issue. As baby boomers get older, the number of licenses sold, deer hunting licenses sold, is going to go down, and the number of kids that we're all having as active hunters is declining because we're aging out of the years when we're going to have children to recruit in our own children. And what that ends up looking like is that we need to reach out to new hunters who don't already participate and figure out a way to expand the brand into segments of the population that may be interested but so far haven't had the opportunity to get started.
And you mentioned that you're looking at these demographics. So if it continues on its current course, what was the projection then as to what we would see?
The current projection is that by 2030, there will be 25% fewer hunters than there were in 2010.
Really? Okay. And that mostly has to do with that demographic decline, with people aging out of hunting.
Yes, the Applied Population Lab was looking at strictly at demographics.
Okay.
And what's happening is a very dramatic increase in the number of females hunting. But even with that dramatic increase, they are unable to make up for the decline in men participating in hunting over the next 15, 20 years.
I know that we had passed wasn't there the law that was passed recently that would allow people to wear blaze pink in the woods?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the number of females participating in deer hunting, though, was on a rapid increase prior to the passage of that law, for sure. It's just, I think, a change in society, a change in interest, a change in the decision-making tactics in people's families, where we're becoming more inclusive and inviting everyone along, and more women are interested in where their food comes from, and sustainable, local, responsibly harvested food is becoming a growing importance to families in Wisconsin.
Well, what other factors are playing a role in, you know, what you're seeing right now with the fewer hunting licenses being sold, I guess? Is the age pretty much the big reason, or are there other factors?
I think age is really the big reason and why the number of hunters is declining from our current hunting population. Some of the other reasons why people might not be getting into hunting as new hunters, getting involved in it, are related to increasing urbanization. Sort of over the past 20 years, there's been a loss of connection with the natural world and the natural environment as people became more concentrated in the cities and the urban areas. Now, I also believe that trend is changing and that we've got a lot more interest now in being outside and more interest in outdoor sports. We're seeing a lot of growth in things like kayaking and stand-up paddleboarding. So that interest is returning, and people really are craving that connection. So I think we have both something that can be a conservation crisis, but also something that could be a great conservation opportunity if we're able to reach out to a number of new people in an up-and-coming generation and get them engaged in hunting and fishing.
Okay, so do you think that there's going to be a shift that's coming then in the way that we pay for conservation programs? Because, I mean, doesn't a lot of the money that we spend from hunting license sales go towards wildlife management?
Yeah, all of the money from hunting license sales and stamp sales and excise taxes goes towards wildlife management and conservation at this point. So conservation funding is heavily dependent upon, you know, maintaining a strong number of hunters and anglers in Wisconsin right now. And, you know, there don't appear to be, that I'm aware of, any changes to the structure of conservation funding on the horizon.
So do you think that's something that needs to be taken into account then, as we're seeing some interest in or growth in other areas? Do you think that that's something that should be included as part of, you know, licenses or fees that we might tap into to help provide funding for conservation programs?
No, what I see is that as a potential new audience for us to educate, recruit into conservation, and also teach them then how to hunt and fish. And that becomes an active part. They take an active role then in conservation and conservation funding.
Well, how has this been impacted? You know, if all of that money is going towards conservation programs, how have they been affected by the decline in the number of hunters that we're seeing?
I can't really tell you about the budgets specifically off the top of my head. I can say that revenues from federal excise taxes on sporting arms and ammunition have been fairly stable or actually increased in the past decade, so that's helped offset any potential decline. And one of the things that we've also learned is that if you offer hunters a new opportunity, for example, crossbow hunting, which just became legal in Wisconsin in the past 5 years, people will buy an additional license. So overall, of a number of hunters participating in the gun deer hunt has gone down. You know, our budgets are determined by total license sales, and total deer license sales, if you include archers and crossbows, have remained fairly stable over this period. And I think a lot of that is due to the new opportunity of crossbow hunting. The number of, looks like crossbow hunting first became legal in 2014. And the number in 2014 was about 44,000 crossbow licenses. By 2017, it looks like it's now 66,000 crossbow licenses. And that's sort of an interesting figure because that's the number of crossbow-specific licenses that were sold. You can also upgrade your archery license from a archery to a crossbow, and the number of people doing that has grown, has just about doubled in the past 4 years as well.
So even though we're seeing some declines with the gun deer hunters or sales of gun deer hunting licenses, we're seeing growth in other areas.
Yeah, there has been some growth in basically what ends up being new opportunities. So we're seeing really some great growth in younger adults who are also interested in hunting from a standpoint of food sourcing issues.
You've added some opportunities here for people like crossbow hunting in recent years. Is that what the state is doing to recruit hunters, or what are some of the things that you're doing to draw more people back into fishing and hunting in the state?
We have a number of strategies that are in place. One is from a hunting and angling perspective is Hunt for Food and Fishing for Dinner programs, which are classes that we teach around the state, which provide a pretty long contact period over a couple of weeks. And then at the end, a mentored hunting situation where people actually get to go out and practice the skills that we've been teaching them. That's mostly targeted at adults and families, getting brand new people engaged in hunting, or people who may be anglers and are interested in hunting can take one of these Hunt for Food courses and get taught to hunt. We have the National Archery in the Schools program, which exposes folks to archery at their school, and then we follow that up with a three-dimensional archery competition program, which we sponsor through our partners, and a lot of partners put that on, which gives people the opportunity then to go and shoot three-dimensional targets. We then follow up and invite them out, have a program that follows up and invites them out to go hunting. There is the, outside of DNR, there's the Wisconsin Interscholastic Fishing Association, which has a series of fishing teams around the state at schools. They're doing a great job of getting older kids interested in angling. And at some point then, of course, you buy a license to go out and go fishing on your own. There is the Scholastic Clay Target Program. Also not, you know, we support that. We endorse that. We aren't running that. That's run by the Scholastic Clay Target Leagues in schools, which are exposing a lot of new people to using shotguns and to being involved in shooting sports. Like I mentioned, we have the Fishing for Dinner program, and Fishing for Dinner is the same as Hunt for Food, where it spends a lot of time teaching families how to fish, where to find fish, where to find gear, which gear to use for which fish at which time of the year. So just providing people who are interested with the hands-on experience to get it done. So there are several of these programs that are out there. There's the Hunter Education Program, which also is a very hands-on program. We have over 3,000 volunteer instructors around the state who can certify people in hunter education safety, which they want to get before they can buy a license. DNR also has the Mentored Hunting Program, where anyone who's interested in hunting can go out and hunt with a mentor without first getting hunter education certification. So sort of a try it before you buy it program for people who would be interested in hunting. So all of these programs that I've mentioned are built around a model of outdoor recreation adoption. And that's just understanding that for anyone to take up another outdoor recreation, they first have to be interested in it, you know, then they have to get an experience in it, and then they have to get repeated trainings and experiences in that until they feel personally ready to follow, you know, their own path or follow their own community that they've become engaged with and go off and hunt on their own. So what's important is providing the connections all the way along those stepping points on the model and making sure people move from interested to recruited to someone who is retained and is able to continue to hunt and fish on their own or with their own within their own community or group. Which leads us to recognizing that a lot of the things that provide only one experience and then don't have a follow-up contact are not going to be as effective as a connected contact. So if we're thinking about that model as a linear or even a circular model of repeated contacts and repeated experiences, then we take these one-time events that folks have and are really good at putting on, and we connect people to one event, to the next event, to the next experience until they get enough experiences and feel like they can continue on their own. So that's the general theory and a whole bunch of the things that we're doing trying to apply to that theory.
So why is that so important then, to keep people connected, to keep them out hunting and fishing and keep that tradition going in Wisconsin?
Oh, well, why is it important to keep the tradition going? Well, I think for us in Wisconsin, it's a big part of the fabric of our lives. It's really important that we continue to have that connection. We always talk up that connection. We're known as a very strong hunting and fishing state. We've got 15,000 lakes that we've worked hard to protect for all of these years. So that legacy and the fact that, you know, in conservation as a hunter and angler, you're giving back, that reciprocity, those are the kind of things that make it really important to have that connection. It's also important for health and wellness. I think there's a whole lot of positive effects on your health and wellness to being outdoors, spending time in the woods, and just if you're walking or sitting or just quiet time, that it has very positive health and wellness effects as well.
Is there anything that I'm missing, Keith, that you would like to add as to, you know, hunters are heading into the woods this weekend or maybe thinking about getting a license ahead of the deer opener?
Well, if people are thinking about getting a license before the year opener, I think that's a great thing. And, you know, one thing to remind people of is if you know of somebody who's interested in hunting or might be interested in hunting, invite them. Find out. If you have that kind of capacity and space, that's an important thing to do. If you're interested in hunting and you know a hunter, contact someone and find out if they may have a spot for you to go, or they may want to take you in and teach you, because what we do know from surveys is that the biggest barrier to participation in hunting is being invited to participate. We also know on the other side of things that the biggest incentive to actually getting started hunting is being invited to go hunting. So it's all about that personal relationship and personal networking. And not everyone is going to have the capacity or the time or the equipment or the deer to take another person hunting. But if some people do, that's what's really going to help us out, help us recruit new hunters in the long run. And to everyone out there who is hunting this weekend, make sure that you keep safety top of mind. That's the most important thing. You know, get your harness, make sure you're harnessed into your tree stand, and make sure that you're following the 4 rules of firearm safety. Those are the biggest things.
Again, you were just listening to Keith Warnke. He's head of hunter recruitment for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll talk with State Representative Nick Milroy. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we hear from State Representative Nick Milroy. The South Range Democrat served on the Natural Resources and Sporting Heritage Committee in the State Assembly. He's been an outspoken advocate for more aggressive action to manage the spread of chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin. He sat down recently to talk about CWD management and the decline of hunters in the state. Last year, you introduced the Save Our Deer Act with Representative Dana Walks. That would have required a number of things, including electronic monitoring of gates and double fencing, and it would have required fence inspections every 2 years, right? So, you know, some of those things have now come to pass because Governor Walker proposed emergency rules earlier this year, but do you feel like the state has been slow to respond to this issue and what we've been seeing with chronic wasting disease across the state?
Yeah, we have a 16-year history with chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin now. The disease was first found 16 years ago, and before that, the only place that it was identified in the United States was 800 miles away to the west. Initially, when it came, it caused quite the controversy, and we did spend a lot of time and money trying to eradicate the disease from the area of the state where it was at. And over time, the general public kind of turned on the management style that we were using, which was trying to kill literally every deer in these hot spots, and a lot of people didn't want to see that continue. And ever since then, we've kind of scaled back our management or trying to slow the spread of CWD. And because of that, the disease has continued to spread. And one of the largest vectors for the spread of the disease, or one of the most dangerous vectors for the spread of the disease, are these deer farms, because people are transporting deer over the highway, you know, in animal trailers, across state lines, to different farms. And this is how, and when you have deer in captivity that are in close proximity to one another, it really increases the risk and likelihood that these deer are going to transmit the disease to each other.
Well, and obviously there's been a lot of debate over that, because deer farmers are saying that they're not to blame for this, that they're the most highly monitored operations across the state because they do sampling all the time. And as you noted, the state that's dropped off because of state and federal funding declining over the years. So what do we need to do then moving forward? I mean, if you take a look at this emergency rule that's in place, that requires double fencing of deer farms over the next year. but it's an emergency rule. It, you know, it could change in 150 days from now. So do you feel like that rule has enough teeth, or do you think that we'll see deer farmers taking steps to comply with that?
Well, I think there's going to be some pushback from the deer farmers. I think they're going to be lobbying the legislature very heavily to try to make sure that the regulations that are put in place on them aren't going to be overly burdensome or costly, and that's understandable. These people are running a business, and you know, they want to turn a profit, but at the same time, as a state, we have an obligation to keep our deer herd healthy, and if these deer farms pose a risk to the wild herd, it's incumbent upon the state, the Department of Natural Resources, and Department of Agriculture, the DATCAP department, to make sure that we're doing whatever we can to try to limit the spread from captive farms to the wild.
Well, what does that look like then? I mean, and just not with the deer farms alone, but, you know, preventing the spread into the wild deer herd across the state. What does that look like? I mean, for example, that emergency rule had a restriction that was placed on carcass transport, but that was suspended by lawmakers. You know, that would have prevented hunters from moving deer out of counties that were CWD affected. Do you think that that was the right move, or do you think that hunters should, you know, not be taking deer out of CWD affected counties?
Yeah, that's a good question. That was a very controversial thing. I was surprised that the governor proposed it. But I think it's an important step. It was something that was proposed through the Wisconsin Conservation Congress. I don't have the results of the vote on that, but I do know it was controversial at the spring hearings. But scientists know that the prions of CWD are in a lot of the bones and brain matter and a lot of the stuff that hunters generally leave behind when they gut a deer or butcher a deer. Most hunters, when they're done butchering a deer, they find a place to dispose of the carcasses in the woods. And traditionally, that's been the accepted way of dealing with it. You put it back in the woods, and other critters are going to scavenge it, and you're not necessarily filling up landfills with organic material that can be used in nature. So that's always kind of been the generally accepted practice. But with the threat of CWD now, we really have to take a hard look at how we are dealing with carcass disposal. A lot of the science has shown that these prions can massively, from the prions from a single carcass, can massively infect a small area. And these prions pretty much live forever. They can be taken up by plant material. Deer can come in years later and eat the grasses around these disposal sites and end up contracting the disease.
And, you know, that was one of the things that came up in the Natural Resources Board meetings this year. I mean, there was a lot of discussion among board members about how we don't have a good way to dispose of deer carcass parts. And now we're seeing deer dumpsters pop up across the state. What do you think needs to be done, or what should the state be doing to address that so that we don't leave anything on the landscape that might further spread the disease?
Well, this is a discussion that we are going to have as a legislature, and this is a discussion that the new administration is going to have with the new administration of the Department of Natural Resources. We know that something has to be done, and we're going to have to figure out a way that's socially acceptable and also isn't going to break the bank. Right now, we have a lot of private citizens and groups that are doing these carcass dumpsters, and you know, this might be a way in the future that the state can partner with groups to make sure that deer carcasses aren't being left on the landscape, especially if they're carcasses that are from CWD infected areas.
You know, and as we've seen this year, the disease has spread to 55 counties now, or 55 counties are considered CWD affected. Why do you think there's so much disagreement among lawmakers over what we should do or how it should be handled? For example, we had a public hearing in October. I think it was the Rules Committee that took that up, and there was this debate between lawmakers and others about whether this should be handled through the emergency rulemaking process or through legislation. How do you think that should be handled?
The specific issue with respect to transporting deer carcasses?
Yeah, as we're looking at ways to reduce the spread of the disease, should it be handled through state rules or should it be handled by lawmakers through bills, through legislation?
I think it's important that you use every tool at your disposal. When you get new information or a new understanding or new ideas, I think it's important that the governor uses their authority to exercise emergency rules if it's going to be in the best interest of the citizens of the state. Now, that being said, there's always legislative oversight. And in this instance, the Committee on the Review of Administrative Rules came back and changed some of the rules that the governor proposed. I think the justification for the people that wanted to do it was that it was too burdensome on the hunting community to impose these rules months before the hunting season starts or weeks before the bow season started, that it was going to cause mass confusion, that people were going to end up getting cited for transporting deer when they probably had no idea that this rule was in effect. It might not have had time to be printed into the regulations. So,
right. How do you get the word out?
Right. So there was some legitimate concerns. But when we're talking about transporting deer carcasses, I think it's important to have in place rules and regulations, even though they're probably almost impossible to enforce, but it's still important to have these rules and regulations in place so that you can get the word out there that this might not be in the best interest of the deer herd, of our hunting tradition, to transport carcasses from one part of the state to the other. It's very similar to what we see with the spread of invasive species, whether it's moving firewood or moving ballast water or bait buckets across the state. This is just another step to try to reduce the risk and the impact to our economy.
Well, and this year too, the agency, the DNR, has been doing more sampling of deer for chronic wasting disease. And that was part of the CWD response plan that came out a couple years ago, that the updated plan. I believe it's including all 19 counties in West Central Wisconsin now, and Lincoln, Oneida, and Marinette counties. You know, are we doing enough right now to monitor for the disease in your mind? Or,
well, we've really cut back on the testing over the years. We've proposed increased funding for testing. You know, there's a really fine line. How much money do you spend on testing to monitor where the disease is, and how much do you spend on trying to eradicate the disease or inform hunters? So, you know, there's difficult decisions. There's always limited financial resources for agencies to deal with these issues. But I do think it's important that we continue to have an aggressive monitoring program, because people do not want to harvest deer or consume deer that potentially could be infected with CWD. So, you know, this is something that people are very concerned about, and they have a right to know where this disease is and where it's spreading to.
So how big an issue do you think chronic wasting disease is going to be as lawmakers head back? I mean, because we're going into the budget process next year, right?
Correct.
So do you think that this issue will be part of discussions, you know, as they're taking a look at the budget? Because you mentioned, you know, there's this discussion over funding and how much we should spend. Do you think that'll come up?
I do. I don't know that there's going to be a great debate on this specific issue. I think there will be, I'm hoping that the new governor will increase funding for CWD testing, management, and research. I'm expecting that he will. I don't know that there will be a lot of pushback. There's so many other larger issues that I think people are concerned about, that when we're talking about the kind of the small pots of money that deal with things like CWD, it's really not on a lot of people's radar.
Well, and do you think there are differences, too, from how this would be handled under Governor Walker as opposed to Governor-elect Evers?
Well, we saw what Governor Walker did for 7.5 years of his 8 years was, you know, pretty much nothing when it comes to trying to slow the spread of this disease. And a lot of that, I believe, was due to the fact that he hired a guy they called the Deer Czar from Texas to come up to Wisconsin.
James Kroll.
Yeah, Dr. Deer. So he came up here, and it was at a time when hunters were very dissatisfied with the size of the deer herd, and people wanted answers. So they hired Dr. Kroll to come here and do a comprehensive study of Wisconsin's deer management. And as part of the report that he put together, his recommendation was taking a hands-off approach to CWD, to, you know, essentially let CWD run its course. And the governor kind of ran with that for 7.5 years. But the last couple of years, we've seen an uptick in the number of deer farms and the number of counties that have been impacted by CWD. And sportsmen really started to take note of that. And the governor recognized that, and I think that's why at the end of his term he did propose those emergency rules to try to get a handle on this.
Yeah, well, it was certainly coming up, too, from conservationists across. And, you know, just here recently we've seen moratoriums put in place in the past year in Bayfield County on deer farms. Mm-hmm. And Douglas County, I believe, has passed or is looking at passing a moratorium on deer farms, just to be aware of what the risks are or study the impacts and possible local regulation that they might look to control any potential spread of the disease. Do you think that chronic wasting disease has impacted the hunting tradition in Wisconsin?
It definitely has, and that's the reason why I take it so seriously. Hunting, obviously, is a very big part of our culture and our tradition, but just as importantly, it brings a lot of money into the state. Some estimates show that the ripple effect of all hunting in Wisconsin contributes $4 billion to our economy, and a big portion of that is the 9-day gun deer season. Wisconsin has one of the largest deer populations in the country and some of the best hunting opportunities. So it's a real destination place for people to come to, and is tremendously important to people on a personal level, but also to the state for financial reasons, which, you know, the money that comes in from hunting goes to support so many other things other than hunting. It supports, you know, trails and waterways and parks and a lot of the work that the Department of Natural Resources does that all Wisconsinites benefit from.
Yeah, and just this week, the Wisconsin Policy Forum came out with a report. It looked at state data to show that the number of deer hunting licenses sold, has dropped 6% in the last 20 years, roughly. You know, as we're seeing fewer hunters, how do you think the state should be addressing them? Because like you said, you know, a lot of what we see with hunting generates revenue for the Fish and Wildlife account, which funds conservation work across the state. You know, what should the state be looking at there?
Well, we've been taking a very aggressive approach to try to retain, recruit, and reintegrate hunters into the sport. and that has included eliminating the minimum age for hunting, which is controversial with some folks, creating a mentored hunter program where anyone can go out hunting with a licensed hunter. They're not required to do the hunter safety. As long as they're with someone who's gone through the hunter safety, they can purchase a mentored hunter license and go out regardless of their age. And we've created some new seasons. A crossbow season has been extremely popular across the state. But we've known that this is an issue and is going to continue to be an issue because of the aging population. This is a nationwide issue where, you know, a lot of folks are, the baby boomers are getting older and they're dropping out of these outdoor activities. But also we have a lot of urbanization going on in the country. Not as many people living in rural areas any longer, so they just don't necessarily have the same roots that they might have to hunting when you grow up in a rural area. So there's just less people that are exposed to it. We have created a lot of programs in Wisconsin to focus on metropolitan areas where there are a large number of people that are interested in harvesting their own food, whether it's wild edible plants or wild game. They want food that they know isn't contaminated with growth hormones and everything else. They want organic type meat, and you know, they want to feel the responsibility of taking the life of the animal that they're eating. So this is kind of a new trend that we're seeing in a lot of urban areas, and we're trying to capitalize on that.
I know conservation groups like the Wisconsin Conservation Congress and Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, they're saying, you know, we should increase fees to bring more revenue in so we can continue to do conservation work. Is that something that you think or agree with, or should we be looking at other sources of revenues?
I do think we need to increase fees. We haven't increased fees for many years, and a year or two ago, all of the major conservation groups in Wisconsin came to the legislature with a proposal to increase fees on themselves. That doesn't happen very often in politics, where a group of people come forward and say, hey, we want you to tax us more. And the reason why they did that is because how much they value the resource that they have. Unfortunately, that didn't go anywhere. And one of the arguments against it, and it's a legitimate argument, is anytime that you raise fees, you are going to push a percentage of people out of the sport. So there has to be careful consideration how much you're going to raise fees and what the impact is going to be on the drop off of people that just aren't going to find it acceptable to pay higher fees for the outdoor activities that they enjoy.
Because you don't want to turn people away from hunting just with sticker shock.
Correct.
But they're pretty inexpensive, though, right now, right? Isn't it like $25 for, or am I wrong on that one?
No, it's generally very inexpensive, especially when you look at you know, how much money people spend on other things, whether it's ammunition or rifles or lodging,
right,
or food, travel. The amount of time people spend preparing for the deer season, the cost of it is really minuscule. But people can be strange. I mean, I've had people call me up and ask me how can they, you know, I've had people from the Minneapolis-St. Paul area call my office and complain to me because they pay $5,000 in property tax on a lake home in my district that they might go to a couple times a year, and they're upset that they have to pay $40 for an out-of-state fishing license and not $25 for an in-state fishing license. So, you know, people can be very strange, and anytime you increase the fees on something, there's a lot of people that get bent out of shape over that.
Yeah, well, I think most people feel like they're being nickel and dimed everywhere you look. But, I mean, like you said, it's striking a balance between the value of hunting and what people can afford.
Right. And there's so many different opportunities to do so many things, not just hunting and fishing, but people are involved in a lot of different things nowadays, and they start running out of time. So, you know, you might think $24 for a hunting license isn't very much, but if you have, you know, a full schedule of youth sporting activities for the 9-day gun season with your kids, you might say, you know what, I'm not going to hunt this year because I'm going to take my kid to soccer practice or basketball practice or whatever. So, you know, I think there's so much going on in people's lives. So many households are working multiple jobs that there's just not the time to do everything that people want to do. And they start making decisions on things that they're going to cut out of their life to try to save money and save time.
It's hard to get away. Are you going to get out there into the woods this weekend?
I am, yeah. Looking forward to it. I haven't had a chance to do a lot of preseason work. In fact, after this interview, I'll be heading out to the woods to set up my deer stand and kind of looking forward to the peace and quiet of the woods.
Again, you were just listening to State Representative Nick Milroy. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. When we come back, we'll review some of the news of the week. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out, and up next, we take a look back on some of the news of the week. A new report by the Wisconsin Policy Forum says the number of deer hunting licenses sold in Wisconsin has dropped about 6% in the last two decades. Fewer hunters is sparking concerns about funding for conservation. Wisconsin Policy Forum Research Director Jason Stein says the state relies largely on license sales to fund conservation work.
Not just for animals that are hunted, but for other animals as well, and including endangered species.
Wisconsin Conservation Congress Chairman Larry Bondi says sporting organizations would like lawmakers to consider raising license fees or seeking other revenue sources.
It could be something like 0.8% sales tax, like some states have tried. It could be raising additional funds through licensing kayaks and canoes, which currently you don't have to.
The report says the number of state staff paid by license revenues declined by 20%, or 144 positions from 1999 to 2017. Timber sales on the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest have increased for the sixth year in a row. This past fiscal year, the forest sold just under 129 million board feet of timber. Forest Supervisor Paul Strong says that's the most timber that's been sold in the National Forest since the early 1990s.
Our ability to work with our state partner, the Wisconsin DNR, under the Good Neighbor Authority that was given to the Forest Service in the 2014 Farm Bill has been huge. They've been a steady partner delivering their share of this program for the last 3 years. And then we've had some fortunate circumstances with Mother Nature in which we've actually gotten more timber volume per acre. The growth has exceeded what our normal expectations are, and that's given us a little bit of a bump beyond our normal expectation.
Loggers harvested about 14,000 acres of more than 860,000 available for timber harvest in the National Forest. Last year, the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest sold 120 million board feet of timber valued at just under $8 million. The U.S. Senate has approved a new policy on ships that dump ballast water in coastal ports and the Great Lakes, a practice blamed for spreading invasive species that damage the environment and the economy. The balanced plan is contained in a $10.6 billion Coast Guard budget authorization bill that passed Wednesday. It now goes to the House for consideration. Environmentalists and the shipping industry have battled for years over regulation of ballast water, which keeps ships upright in rough seas. Under the bill, the Environmental Protection Agency would continue setting rules requiring ships to treat ballast water before it's discharged. The Coast Guard would enforce them. States could not set regulations tougher than those on the federal level, but Great Lakes regional standards could be established if enough states agree. La Crosse-based Dairyland Power Cooperative and Minnesota Power held an open house in Superior this week about plans to build a $700 million natural gas facility. They say it will supply power when they're unable to draw from renewable sources like wind and solar. The natural gas plant would produce at least 525 megawatts of power. Minnesota regulators approved the proposal 2 weeks ago. Now Julie Pierce with Minnesota Power says they hope to secure permits in Wisconsin.
Both of us have been on a journey to make our power supplies less carbon intense, keep it reliable, and very affordable for customers.
But Courtney Cochran with Minnesota's Sierra Club chapter says they'd like to stop the project in Wisconsin.
They both talk about getting to a renewable future, and taking a step towards natural gas is not the right step. If we're looking towards a renewable energy future, it's adding another fossil fuel into the system.
The two utility providers hope to begin the permitting process with the Public Service Commission and other agencies early next year. The city of Superior will spend around $1 million in community development block grant money next year to improve housing, sidewalks, and support community service agencies. Around $300,000 will go to One Roof Community Housing to rehab homes in Superior. Port Planning and Economic Development Director Jason Cirque says the city will use CDBG funds to reimburse One Roof for repairs they're doing for low to moderate income homeowners.
You know, the goal there is to preserve housing. That's the number one goal, but also to help folks that couldn't afford it, maybe some life safety improvements, maybe a new furnace, just to be able to afford that and to be able to improve their home.
Noah Hobbs is the lending director with One Roof. He says they've rehabbed around a dozen households in Superior over the last 3 years. He says the money will allow them to make repairs to another 7 to 14 homes next year.
In the Twin Ports region, we have an aging housing stock that is coming towards the end of their useful life without significant rehab. If we're able to rehab homes to maintain the quality and functionality of it, you extend the life effectively, which is actually cheaper than building new. And it's important for folks to have decent, safe, and affordable housing throughout the community.
In addition to rehabbing homes, Cirque says $97,000 will go to support community service groups in the city.
We work with a lot of groups like Boys and Girls Club or Harbor House, where we're funding, you know, it's small amounts, it's modest amounts to help their programs. But we also have what we call kind of the city side, which is another set of money that the council approves for sidewalks or for One Roof, or we fund some activities in the Business Improvement District for facade improvements from an economic development standpoint.
Cirque says funding for the city's Community Development Block Grant Program has decreased from about $1.4 million to roughly $700,000 over the last 15 years. He says that's due to more communities who have been served by the nationwide program and a decline in federal funding. The Salvation Army in Superior recently launched its annual Red Kettle campaign and is looking for volunteers. As Olivia Shalaby reports, these Red Kettles help fund the Salvation Army all year long.
Every year, people volunteer to ring bells and gather donations for the Salvation Army in Superior. Corps Officer and Captain Jason Elkham says most of their annual budget comes from this campaign. This year, he says their goal is to gather $65,000 through the Red Kettles. Elkham says the donations fund their operations.
We have different programs that operate all year long, programs for homelessness, programs for rehabilitation, drug addiction, stuff like that, as well as just basic needs such as putting food on the tables, getting warm clothing, and paying for utility bills or rental assistance when people get behind.
Without the Red Kettle campaign, Elkham says the Salvation Army would close its doors. He says they've received large donations in the past, but they're grateful for whatever people can afford to give to help those in need.
At one point, we had a stack of $100 bills stacked upon each other, so it was a $1,000 cash donation. But we get checks for large amounts sometimes. At one location that we were at, we actually received a $5 gold American $5 coin that was worth over $200.
Elkham says they're looking for volunteers to ring bells from now until Christmas Eve at Walgreens, Walmart, and Super One stores in Superior. The Salvation Army serves around 400 people each month. The Red Kettle campaign will run from now until Christmas Eve. Olivia Shalaby, Wisconsin Public Radio.
People can sign up to volunteer through the Salvation Army's Facebook page at facebook.com/SA Superior. The Brick Ministries in Ashland is seeing about 1,600 people each month at the four food shelves they serve in Ashland, Mellon, Cable, and Cornucopia. Executive Director Liz Seafelt says they serve about twice that many people each year.
Because people, you know, they might need services for a couple of months. Maybe they lost a job, but then they get a job again, and they don't qualify for services because they their income is over the income guidelines. We're serving folks who are at 185% of federal poverty level.
Seafelt says that's a family of four who makes less than $47,000 a year. As the holidays draw near, she says they're seeing more stress among the people they serve.
That anxiety level for our consumers, you can really feel that increase because our consumers, you know, they're living on the edge already. And then there are the additional expectations that come along with the holidays to not just put food on the table, but to put a nice, huge feast on the table.
Despite low unemployment, Seafelt says people may struggle to find work in the off-season or grapple with drug and alcohol abuse.
Then there are always the folks who are maybe have less potential for changing their situation over time. Maybe it's going to be somebody who's retired and is only drawing on Social Security and doesn't have any other, you know, pension or retirement, 401k, anything like that to add to their Social Security.
She says donations and volunteers are always welcome. The Brick Ministries is currently looking for items for their food pantry, as well as things like soap and personal hygiene products. And that's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Have a great rest of your weekend.